mental illness, you know, may tend to do in public spaces. And as a community, we don't have a whole lot of tolerance for that. So police pick them up, law enforcement pick them up because there's some sort of situation that they view as untenable. Often it's not a criminal situation per se, and law enforcement may not have a stake in prosecuting a crime in order to protect public safety. A lot of times we see crimes like disorderly conduct, trespass, failure to appear, these small kind of nuisance crimes. But law enforcement don't have a whole lot of alternatives to jail. There aren't a lot of resources and places where, you know, alternative destinations. And so that's kind of the dynamic that funnels people into the criminal justice system, really, because of behaviors related to mental illness.
Can you speak to the what the report refers to as the jail's flawed continuum of care, and how inmates are treated with isolation, discipline? You mentioned force and deprivation.
So what we refer to as the jail's flawed continuum of care is the fact that in the absence of a strong clinical presence, that the tools that deputies have at their disposal are corrections tools. And the stark reality of that is that behavior that's related to mental illness, when it happens in jail, is usually met with use of force, violence, putting a spit sock on somebody's head, putting them in a restraint chair, maybe using a taser, putting them in conditions of extreme isolation and sensory deprivation, solitary confinement. Suicide watch often involves removing the individual's clothing, putting them in a suicide smock, removing their bedding, sometimes even their mattress, removing all of their personal belongings, denying them access to visits, phone. So, you know, it's a real climate of deprivation. And I think the response that we've gotten from individual deputies is, you know, I don't feel any bad intent. These are the tools that I have. I haven't been trained in how to identify mental health crisis behavior or how to respond to it. I just, you know, kind of follow these protocols, which is, you know, in most cases, I think, true. But the way it feels for the individual who's on the receiving end, I think, is very violent and frightening.
And so what do you think accounts for that gap between those who are charged with overseeing the incarceration and housing of these people who are have been criminalized for the mental condition that they're in, and the people that are experiencing the violence for being seen and categorized as criminals just because they are viewed as mentally unstable or incapable of negotiating the world on their own?
So I think that violence is inherent in the structure of jail, any jail, not just Multnomah County Jail. Jails are closed to any outside scrutiny, right? The public can't view what's going on there. The public doesn't get to enter the jail, so there's no transparency. Jails are punishment-driven, so, you know, every system, whether it's use of the restraint chair or suicide watch or the disciplinary process, all of those processes are punishment-oriented processes. It's not like a clinical setting where you're thinking about the therapeutic benefit of an intervention. And jails are starkly hierarchical, both in their staffing pattern and in the relationship between staff to detainees or inmates. So I think the combination of those three ingredients is a recipe for violence, and that violence is just inherent in the structure of the jail. And that's why in our recommendations we really emphasize that the long-term solution is decriminalization. It's keeping people out of jail, especially people who have mental health issues and are particularly vulnerable and particularly in need of behavioral health care.
And were you able to witness any of these methods that are used regularly in jails all across the country, like well, like, what does a restraint chair look like, or what is it? What is a spit sock? I think that's the term you use.
Sure. So there's a picture of a restraint chair in the report that's available at Disability Rights Oregon's website, but it looks like a it looks like a chair, and the individual can be fastened at various points against the chair. And a spit sock is, picture someone with a stocking over his head. It's a snug-fitting barrier that prevents an individual from spitting and getting that spit on people around him or her. So, no, I didn't witness anyone in the restraint chair or in a spit sock. I certainly have seen people who are on suicide watch. And in other contexts, I've watched video footage of people in restraint chairs. It's a pretty common tool in any jail or prison.
What does a suicide watch entail? Is it treated as though the individual that's on suicide watch is a hazard to their own health? Are they treated as, like, essentially a threat to themselves and kind of by extension a criminal? Or are they kind of dealt with, are they interacted with a little bit of compassion? What kind of, conditions do inmates receive when they're in suicide watch? And also, are they in a normal cell or are they in a different type of cell?
Sure. So suicide watch is really prevalent in jails. I think about 1,500 people per year at Multnomah County Jail are put on suicide watch. So it's not rare. The theory, and this is kind of corrections folklore, the idea is that if you make suicide watch too cushy of an environment, then people will fake suicidality in order to avoid disciplinary segregation. So the result of that is that suicide watch is one of the most restrictive settings in the jail. It's as restrictive as disciplinary segregation. And what the protocol generally involves is to remove the individual's clothing, remove all of their personal belongings, sometimes remove their bedding and mattress. So, remove anything that they could possibly use to harm themselves with, and then put them in a regular cell in a specific part of the jail, and then use deputy observation to make sure that they're safe. And then there's a visit from mental health staff, and only a mental health staff person can take a person off of suicide watch. So what our recommendation is that when you make suicide watch punitive, you actually make the jail less safe because people are deterred from coming forward and voicing their suicidal feelings because they don't want to get put in that smock and put into those terrible conditions. So what we've suggested is that the jail make any restrictions based on a clinician's determination about what actually might pose a danger to the individual. And then the primary tool in order to keep people safe is one-on-one observation, just keeping eyes on the person. So it may be possible, even in some circumstances, to keep the person in his or her regular housing, hopefully engaged in programming, getting visits with family, getting phone calls, having access to a book or some reading material, because those are all actually things that help ameliorate feelings of despair and suicidality. But just keeping eyes on that person, and if any of those items becomes a problem, you can always intervene at that point, but it shouldn't be a blanket across the board deprivation of everything.
And kind of getting more to more of the, I guess, remedial or recommendations part of the report, can you kind of highlight what you see as the most achievable first steps to take in order to reduce the amount of harm that's being done to those suffering mental illness that are currently in our systems of incarceration, specifically, I guess, the Multnomah County Jail?
Sure. So kind of walking through the recommendations, our first set of recommendations focuses on decriminalization. So the big one is we need to invest upstream in services like community mental health care and dual diagnosis treatment options for people who have a substance abuse issue and a mental health issue, and housing. And those investments upstream keep people out of the criminal justice system, and really it's an investment in community stability that benefits all of us. Another, I think, really concrete recommendation is expanding the LEAD, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, to include potential charges that are mental illness-related charges. In terms of improving conditions in the jail, we're recommending that mental health people with mental health issues in the jail be moved to Inverness, which is a much better facility. It doesn't have it's not set up as all single cell housing. There's better access to the outdoors and fresh air, and it doesn't have the disproportionate rates of violence that occur at MCDC, and it also could provide access to programming. And then we're recommending investments in additional clinical staffing, discharge planning, services and programming, so that people in the jail can get their behavioral health care needs met, ending solitary confinement for people with mental illness. That's a really important recommendation. It's something that I think is pretty clearly constitutionally required, in addition to being just a good humane practice.
I've been speaking with Disability Rights Oregon staff attorney Sarah Radcliffe, who has just released a report called A Merry-Go-Round That Never Stops, Mental Illness at Multnomah County Detention Center. In extensive detail, the report highlights how, in many ways, prisoners at the local jail are punished for having mental conditions. For more, you can go to droregon.org. I really appreciate you taking the time aside to talk with me about this.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your interest in the report and in these issues. And, you know, our intent at this point is just to, you know, try to get this information out there and generate some interest. There are some call to action items that we're encouraging people to participate in, like calling your county commissioners. And there are a few bills in the legislature this session that focus on issues that, you know, kind of chip away at the criminalization of mental illness. So that's all information that's available on our website.
And what is your website for listeners who are not in front of a computer right now?
Sure. It's droregon.org.
With KBOO News, I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project annual benefit show on Friday, March 10th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Blue Mountain's Biodiversity Project is a forest defense organization that has been successfully defending eastern Oregon forests for the last 25 years against ecological destruction. This benefit features music by A Stick, A Stone, Cinder Well, and Johanna Warren, as well as humor, storytelling, and more. Again, that's the Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project annual benefit show on Friday, March 10th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is KBOO Portland.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive PDX. We are here tonight with a very special show. Our show tonight is about trans feminism, trans exclusive radical feminism, and the Title IX.